This is a UVic Oral History Program interview with Mr. Douglas Hudson, D-O-U-G-L-A-S-H-U-D-S-O-N, recorded on the 7th of November 2005 at Mr. Hudson's Esquimalt home. He's being interviewed by myself, undergraduate student Matthew Chapman. This is tape one, side one. Okay, Mr. Hudson, I was wondering if you could start off by just telling me a little bit about where you were born and raised.
Born in Manitoba. In Winnipeg I was born, but I was raised on a farm east of Winnipeg, 15 miles, in a farming community, mixed farming community, called Dugald, Manitoba. Dugald. In 1921, November the 21st, and the family of my father came from the United States in 1900, and was educated in that area, what schooling there was in those days. And they homesteaded there, his father homesteaded there, who was a Canadian from Lanark, Ontario. But they'd gone to the United States because there was no way to get to the West, the Canadian West. So they homesteaded in North Dakota. And when the Winnipeg area was starting to open up and be surveyed, they came back to Canada, and then they lived in Canada the rest of their life. We still have relatives down there, but we've lost track of them.
Right, and that's
we've never maintained contact.
And that was in North Dakota?
In North Dakota.
North Dakota, okay. And that was your father was the...
He was born in North Dakota.
In North Dakota, okay, I understand.
My grandfather was born in Lanark, County, Ontario.
Oh, I see.
And they came up through the Great Lakes, and I guess to into North, in Minnesota.
Okay.
And then cross into North Dakota.
Oh, very interesting. And as far as your family history goes, had any of them been involved in the military?
Not that I know of.
Not that you know
of. There's no record of that.
Okay.
My grandfather came, my great-grandfather settled in Lanark County, Ontario, and we tried to trace his whereabouts, where he came from, etc. But there was three William Hudsons in Ontario at that time. No indication of which one.
No, I see.
They came to Quebec City and made their way up into Ontario.
Okay. Okay. And now, as far as your personal history in Manitoba, then, had you ever flown in an aircraft?
No.
So it was a new experience for you?
Early in the war, there was a cordite plant opened up just east of Winnipeg, and I worked at that cordite plant and became friendly with a chap who did some recreational flying. And he used to rent an aircraft out of Stevenson Field, known that that was Winnipeg's airport then.
Right.
And I used to go flying with him. He'd invite me to fly with him.
What type of aircraft was that?
Oh, I don't know. It was just a single-engine aircraft.
Oh, very nice.
Cabin.
Yeah. And that was before you joined the RCIA?
Yeah,
okay. Okay, and then I guess as far as what made you decide to join the RCAF in particular, nothing in particular?
That had no bearing on my intention was to join the Canadian Navy. And I stayed on the farm with my father until I was 21 and got my call, because my sister waited till she was 16, so that she would be able to drive a tractor. So when she got 16, I guess we figured she was old enough to drive a tractor.
See.
So I went to Winnipeg to join the Navy. It was only 15 miles away. In those days, you had to take a train. And I walked down Main Street to get to Ellis Avenue to join the Navy, who were located on Ellis Avenue. And on the way down, I looked up and there was a sign, RCIF's recruiting. So in a split second, I did a 90-degree turn and went in and said to the chap, "Can I get in air crew?" He said, "Sit down and sign this." So that's how I got in air crew.
No time wasted. Oh, wow. Now, as far as
as you said, you wanted to be air crew. Was there any particular, I guess at that point, probably didn't know what...
No, I didn't know anything, period. I did not know anything about air crew.
Oh, wow, okay. So
I just sat and said, I sat down then, and he said, oh, yeah, sit down here and sign this, so I did. And then, of course, they had a selection process that I had to go through. And they said, well, with what little education you've got, you'll be a tail gunner. And I said, no, I won't. I said, I'm going to be something else. So I said, I'm a musician. I play a guitar, which qualifies me to become a wireless operator.
Good ear.
So they said, okay, that's fine. You can be there. So I ended up after boot camp. I was sent home for 3 months because everything was plugged full of people. They had recruits ahead of the building to process them.
Wow.
So they sent me home for 3 months.
So now when you say boot camp, was that at a depot or was that...
No, that was down at Lachine, Quebec.
Okay, Lachine, Quebec. And then, so you went through your boot camp, yeah. And then you had the 3 weeks, and then you were called back?
I was called back.
And where did you go then?
Went to wireless school in... went to Brandon College.
Brandon College, okay.
To take a math and physics brush-up.
Okay.
And I was there for 3 months.
And then I
was posted to Winnipeg Wireless School, No. 3 Wireless School in Winnipeg, to start my wireless training.
And had you had any experience with any wireless equipment before? So that was all brand new?
We had crystal sets in those days.
Crystal sets.
Yeah.
And then I was in the training was this school in Winnipeg, you said?
Yes, it was No. 3 Wireless School.
Winnipeg, okay.
And I graduated from there, somewhere out in the top 10%.
And how long was that training at the number
Pretty
three
well
school?
Well, a year.
1 year, okay.
Because you had to learn another language. You had to learn Morse code.
Right.
And it's just like learning another language. And it's very concentrated. We worked 6 days a week in school.
And what was the proficiency requirement for words per minute? For
25 words.
25.
And you had to volunteer for that because they asked for 20. And if you wanted to get 25, you had to volunteer to take the tests. And there was a series of, I think it was 15 or 20 tests that you had to pass. 80%.
And
then you got qualified for 25 words a minute.
Okay, and then was 25 a requirement for wireless operators?
No,
that was just 20.
20.
Oh, wow. Okay, then. So that would explain the top 10%.
Yeah.
Okay, so you graduated from there, and you said that took about a year. So and then after that, were you posted directly overseas?
No. I was posted to... Dauphin, Manitoba, Paulson, Manitoba, Paulson, to take my gunnery course, because we were wireless air gunners.
Right.
We would fill in for injured gunners, but I never touched a gun, strictly wireless. We carried 3 gunners at one time.
On the Halifax?
On the Halifax. Before H2S was installed in the aircraft, they had a pod under the belly of the aircraft where there was a third gunner strapped in there.
Right, and that was kind of a result of the night fighters that were fired.
The night fighters were up, they had forward slanting guns that would come under your belly.
I think they called them Jazz or something.
Yeah, that's right.
That's
a certain name for it.
Okay, so, okay, so you were posted to Paulson, Manitoba, and you took a gunnery.
Graduated from there.
Okay.
And then was posted overseas. No, I was posted to Boundary Bay.
Oh, really? Oh, wow.
Because, the West Coast had squadrons out here to protect the coast or fly up and down the coast.
Right.
And my 4 o'clock in the morning, it was Ottawa, California in our home. I was home on 2 weeks on vacation leave. And my father answered the phone, and he was all confused. So somebody in Ottawa didn't realize that the time changed for West Coast. None of them know about it, apparently, in those days. Anyway, my father got all confused, and I woke up, and I went down and took the phone, and it was for me. With the advice that I was my posting to Boundary Bay was canceled, that I was going overseas, and I was to report to Lachine, Quebec.
So did you ever end up going to Boundary Bay?
No, never got there.
Okay.
That canceled that.
Okay, and then you were sent to Quebec.
Yeah, sent to Lachine, Quebec.
Lachine, okay.
Where they gathered people bound overseas.
And then from there you took a ship over?
Yeah, we went to Halifax by train and then boarded a ship and went overseas.
And whereabouts, when you initially arrived overseas, whereabouts were you stationed?
Or well, we arrived in Liverpool anyway, and we got on a train, and they gave us beans on toast, and the first time in my life I'd ever had beans on toast. And I was posted to Bournemouth in the south of England. All air crew was posted there, waiting further moves.
How long did you have to wait before you were moved on?
Well, I was only there a couple of weeks, and I was posted to a place called RAF Millom, M-I-L-L-O-M. And we flew, do square searches over the Irish Sea.
Okay.
And Mark 1 Anselms.
So just to step back a bit, what was when was the first time that you were actually trained in aircrew? Was that back at the Wireless Operating School in Winnipeg?
Right.
Okay. And then... Do you recall what type of air, were those Ansons as well, or do you recall
type
No,
our gunnery, no, we flew Fleet Forts out of Winnipeg.
Okay.
And Tiger Moths for our airborne communications,
so.
The wireless part of our training at number 3 wireless school.
Okay. And then when you were...
From there, we were posted to Paulson, Manitoba to take our gunnery training.
Right. And that aircraft would have been, do you recall?
Bolingbroke.
Okay.
And Lysanders. Lysanders pulled the drogues, and they used to carry us to control the drogues.
Oh, I see. And then, so you say, sorry, then back to RAF Millom, you were flying Ansons, doing pattern searches?
Yeah, doing square searches over the Irish Sea for downed aircraft.
And so then you never went through a training or initial, like, advanced training unit before being sent there?
No, that was the advanced
training. Oh, that was the okay.
AFU.
Right.
Advanced flying unit on Mark 1 Ansons, doing square searches over the Irish Sea and training navigators and WAGs.
Okay. And what date would that have been? What year would that have been when you first started flying?
44.
Okay. And would that have been, do you recall, in the wintertime or summertime? I'm just to get a basic understanding.
We're early in the year.
Early 44. Okay. So then after, I guess, at your advanced flight unit then, you were doing these searches. Did you end up finding crews in your searches, or was it a?
No, we were just.
It was just training. Okay.
The WAGs and navig, we were under training, getting trained, navs and navigators and wireless operators, over the Irish Sea.
Okay.
In Mark 1 Ansons.
I understand.
The first Ansons ever built.
Oh really?
You had to crank up the undercarriage.
Oh. It's good for the arms. Mm-hmm. In this training, or I guess after this training, were you sent to an operational training unit after that?
Yeah, we went to an operational training unit at Ossington near Nottingham. And there we flew in...
Just just double training.
They were ex-Bomber Command aircraft. They were replaced by un-Bomber Command.
Whitleys or Wellingtons?
Yeah.
Or about twin engine?
Yeah,
okay.
Twin engine. I didn't think I'd ever forget the name of it.
I could probably research that and find that out. Okay, now just to get into some more theoretical things, as far as how you experienced your training, back in Manitoba, going from Manitoba to overseas, how comfortable were you with the training you'd received thus far? It was a year-long program, I understand, so it was fairly intensive.
Yeah, it was intensive, okay. And it was, I didn't know any better, I just did it,
sure.
You know. I didn't find it difficult,
okay.
But I worked hard at it, and because of my educational background, I had to work hard at it, and I did. 3 hours a night I put in.
No. that sounds like it was quite the experience. And then in your training at your AFU, doing pattern searches, now was that a Canadian unit that was doing the training?
No, it was an RAF station. There were Canadians there.
Right.
You know, but
okay.
It was an RAF base, and our introduction to the base when we got there by the wing commander, RAF, and he said, his first statement was, I have no use for Canadians.
And colonials.
that was a good start, I'll tell you.
Besides the maybe some tension involved there, the actual training was quite useful then?
Oh, yes, it was good, yeah.
Okay.
It was a worthwhile experience for our first exposure to operational flying, really.
Right. Yeah. And And were your instructors there? Did they have operational experience in the
Not
war?
Really.
Not
no,
really. Okay.
They didn't have to. The pilots just flew aircraft.
Sure. Yeah, I guess the pilots doesn't really matter too much. Now, again, jumping back, in Canada, were any of your instructors involved, or did they have operational experience?
No.
Okay, so you then went to your OTU, Operational Training Unit, in Ossington near Nottingham, and what type of training went on there?
Well, that's where we flew these geodetic construction aircraft.
Okay. Which I'm not familiar with those.
Well, that's, you know, it was all metal.
Oh, I see, yes,
yeah.
Right.
with a fabric skin.
Okay, fabric skin. I imagine you could put your foot through that fairly easily.
Well, no, the squares were only about, you know,
right.
It was solid. It was all metal geodetic construction.
Right.
With a fabric skin.
I understand. Okay. And then as far as your training on those aircraft, what particular duties were you trained to do?
Well, for the wireless operating.
Right.
We set up procedures to. For us to carry out during these flights, this training, because they were training pilots as well, and they gave us procedures and tests that we had to do.
Okay.
And contact with ground stations.
And this was an RAF unit as well.
That's right. That was RAF.
Okay.
But the CO was a Canadian.
Oh, he was.
And he had gone over there. He was one of the pre-war Canadians that went over to the RAF.
Oh, I see.
In the 1930s, there was a huge number of Canadians went over there and joined the RAF.
Right.
And he was one of them.
Okay. And many of those Canadians then went on to, well, some of them went on to 6th Group when they did for him? Or,
no.
Oh, this was well after?
Yeah,
okay.
Well after that.
I understand. Okay. Now, how long of a time did you spend at your operational training unit? Was that a few weeks
About
or
3 months.
3 months.
Because we crewed up there.
Oh, you were. And how did that take place? Was that something you were?
Well, I just got air crew from all over Canada, put them in a building and find your own crew.
Really? So totally up to you.
Yeah. And I was one of the last to crew up. I guess maybe I was the last because I didn't want to push it.
Oh, really?
I just hung back.
Huh.
And I said, somebody will come along.
Really?
And want me. So I didn't push myself on in any way there. Finally, I think I was about the last one left And this pilot came looking to round out his crew. And which, he found me because he was nobody else left. So he already had his navigator. But he needed a WAG, of course, and a flight engineer.
Right.
And two gunners. So he had, he had his navigator. And then I met them, and we sort of hit it off. So that was it. He had his crew, rounded out his crew, we picked up a couple of gunners. And that was how it happened, that I got in with this crew, and then one of the last crews to be crewed up of the hundreds that we started out with. So anyway, he lives now here in Victoria. Now, he was from Victoria.
What is his name?
Bob McMillan.
Bob McMillan, I think I've heard of him.
And he, well, if you... his father had Coffee Max, the restaurant on the gorge.
Oh, okay.
And across the road is the car wash.
Okay, yeah. Oh, so he's a local boy then. So he was from Victoria.
Yeah.
Okay, excellent. And and so obviously you didn't know any of these individuals before.
No.
So it was all okay. And then once you were crewed up, did you do your operational training with that crew?
With that crew.
Okay.
OTU.
Okay, and then in the OTU, as far as training, now we've already talked a little bit about what you did. Now, as far as some of the equipment that was used during the war, the kind of the famous equipment, the GEOBO H2S, were you ever trained on any, even though it might not have been your primary duty, were you ever trained on any of the equipment in an operational training?
Oh, yes, sure.
You were?
Sure.
Okay.
OTU is where I was introduced to the to the aircraft, the radio equipment that was already on operational aircraft.
Okay.
And the radio transmitter and then receiver.
And was that the same equipment as that was on the Halifaxes when you
Yes.
did? Okay.
Yes.
And, okay. And then I guess by the time you were actually posted to an operational unit, you were obviously fairly well, or were you fairly well adept with the equipment?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
No problem.
It's a lot of time.
And then we, following OTU, we went to CON unit. Conversion unit.
Right, the heavy.
And we converted to four engine aircraft there. Well, mainly pilot and the engineer. But we flew on Mark 2s and 7s, Halifaxes. They were inline engines.
Right, that wasn't a Hercules. So
no, it was
the older ones. Now, you flew on the Mark II in the conversion unit and,
yes.
and the 7. Now, when you were posted to your actual unit, was what aircraft? Was it a Mark III?
Mark III's.
Oh, I see.
With radio engines.
Right.
Much more reliable.
Right. The Mark IIs, they had a problem with the tail stabilizer.
Yeah, well, not only that, they used to lose power on takeoff.
Okay.
Very opportune time.
Yeah, yes, no doubt. And how much time then were you in the heavy conversion unit then? Before you were actually put on?
6 weeks.
6 weeks, okay. And do you, you might not know, but roughly how many hours of actual flight time would that have been?
Oh, I don't know.
No, but
I got my log book.
Okay. Sure, yeah, I can, yeah, I'll just put this on pause for one sec. Okay, so we're just looking at Mr. Hudson's log book here.
Daylight there.
Okay. So 20 hours in wireless, okay.
And another time we got 34 hours here.
Yeah, and that was with wireless as well?
Wireless school, yes.
Okay.
And then we got to... gunnery school... 6 and a quarter hours, or 6:25 on daylight, and 5:30 on night.
Okay. And that gunnery school was also in Manitoba?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Okay. Also in Manitoba. And then we move we stay there. This is a gunnery school too in Manitoba. 1350
So that'd be on top of the
that's right.
6 hour. Okay.
Plus 620 at night.
Okay, well that's quick. Yeah.
And then we move to Milla.
Okay.
Advanced flying unit.
Right.
28-25 day.
Okay.
14-45 night. And these were navigation exercises,
right.
Bombing exercises, navigation exercises.
And that was
at Milla.
That was over the Irish Sea?
Irish Sea.
Right.
And then we moved to OTU, Lossington OTU.
Right.
And flying Wellingtons.
Oh, Wellingtons. Okay, that was the one. Right, the twin engine.
Yeah.
That's what I believe 420 was flying before the Halifax.
That's right, they were.
Right.
55-50 day. Fifty-three hours night.
Okay. So that's a significant amount of time, I guess, for getting into it. So you felt well trained by the time.
And then we moved to Topcliff, which is a heavy climb unit. That's where we converted to Halifax aircraft, and circuits and bumps and so forth, air to air, cross country, bombing flights,
right.
Fighter affiliation, 32-30 day and 720 nights. And then we moved to the squadron.
The squadron, okay.
420 squadron.
420 squadron, right. And that was based in Thorthorp, but where?
At Falthorpe.
Falthorpe, sorry. Okay. All right. Now we start
circuits and bumps to get on.
Right.
Some Mark 3s.
Going around there.
And then our first raid was on the 4th of November, 1944.
4th of November.
And it was a place called Bochum, Germany. And my comments here, this is 11,000 pounds high explosive, heavy flak and searchlights.
And that was a German target, so I...
It was Bochum, yes.
Bochum, right. And, okay, so heavy flak and searchlights.
That's what my notes here. Heavy flak and searchlights.
Right.
A real introduction to the war.
Right, I imagine that would have been a bit of a...
And then the second one was a daylight to Gelsenkirchen.
Okay.
5.25 hours. Third one was another daylight to Munster, light flak, 6 hours. And we had to divert from that. We had 9 diversions altogether. Didn't get back to base.
And that was because of weather, or
weather, fuel, flak damage.
Okay.
There was emergency drones on me. A place called Thornaby, it had a runway 3 runways wide and 3 miles long for cripples.
Right, that was I'm sure a well used base.
On one particular raid, we were diverted there. We knew we couldn't make home, so we went landed there, and we. On the approach, there were three aircraft burning on the runway. Mm. So we got down and pulled off and then ran like hell.
Oh.
Just adrenaline.
Okay,
and now then another up to Munster. Yeah, okay, let's cover that. Kastrup Roxel, heavy flak.
That was on the 12th of November, 44?
Yeah,
21st. The 21st, sorry.
Yeah. That was the 5th grade. And we diverted to Leeming there.
Again, that would probably have been because of flak damage?
Fuel.
Okay. Actually, just to get back to actually that topic in particular, for fuel, and I guess there was a bit of a compensation made for bomb load and fuel.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Right. But did you feel that you had, I guess it was more of a pilot's decision, but on taking off, was the crew comfortable with the fuel loads that they'd received?
Oh, yeah. Right. Well, it didn't involve me, but
no.
I'm sure the pilot was, on the briefings, they would be given the fuel loads and the distance from the target and the weather, etc.
Right.
So he would be fully aware of his situation.
Okay.
There's one instance on takeoff, by this time there was snow on the